This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This is AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Every week, speaker, consultant Mark AmTower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. AmTower Off-Center with your host, Mark AmTower.
Welcome to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio. This is the official radio show of FY 2013. I'm Mark AmTower. You like that, Dave? My guests today are Dave Pereira, editor of Fierce Government IT and head of government pubs at Fierce Markets, and Steve Charles, the co-founder of Immix Group, which is, Steve will explain that himself, because they're so much more than they appear to be. Steve, Dave, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Steve, start off. Give me the breadth and depth of what Immix does here.
Sure. So Immix was founded back in 96 to help commercial technology manufacturers and software publishers grow their business in the federal marketplace. We provide a mix of services, starting with contract vehicles, lead generation, sales activities, marketing activities, straight on through to contract actions and closeout for the benefit of the technology manufacturers and software publishers in this market.
Okay. And you save, as the go-between between the manufacturers and government, you save everybody on the private side massive headaches.
Well, that's very true. These publicly held companies have to speak to generally accepted accounting practices and uniform commercial code when it comes to their legal transactions. And here in the marketplace, we have government accounting practices and the federal acquisition regulations. So we are a translator and a facilitator, and we're doing it for very low margins, very streamlined, paperless. It's becoming more efficient every day.
And you're growing, which is cool.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Dave, what do you do over at Fierce?
Well, I'm head of government publications, for which there are four now. And I'm also directly the editor of three of them, including Fierce Government IT.
There's four now?
There's four now. Yeah, we got Fierce Government IT, Homeland Security, Government, and Mobile Government.
Cool. Okay. I haven't been paying that much attention. You also jointly over the last couple of years have been working on something that just came out, and I got my copy about 2 weeks ago, The Inside Guide to the Federal IT Market, a new book chock full of absolutely priceless information. The book does focus on IT. Obviously, both of you guys focus on IT. But I guess was beyond that, was there a reason that the book focuses just on IT? Because a lot of the stuff in here definitely applies to multiple sectors.
Well, it doesn't just focus on IT. There's a lot of general knowledge in there. In fact, you don't need to be an IT contractor in order to get a lot out of that book. There are chapters in there that talk very specifically about IT issues, but the sections on contracting, on getting started in the market, on GSA schedules, even though the examples we take are from IT Schedule 70, they apply across to anybody who wants to do business with the federal government.
Right. The acquisition process for everything has a baseline that is true for everything. And that is the baseline for this book. We just make sure that we do address the things that are unique to the IT market, because Congress has passed some laws that pertain specifically to IT. Mm-hmm. And so we address those specifically. But we've also left ourselves open for the opportunity down the road to recast the book for other marketplaces.
Yeah, the IT is always the one in D.C. in the news. Mm. But, you know, if you want to talk, you know, apply this to facilities, how many facilities does government have outside of postal and DOD? GSA manages probably about 15,000 facilities nationwide. State Department has hundreds, if not thousands, overseas. Post office, you know, you add that in, you add in DOD. There's just a few.
Well, sure. I have to admit that architecture and engineering and construction in particular does have some specific regulations to that market, which we did not address. So excluding architecture and engineering, it's pretty universally applicable.
Yeah. Well, but again, a lot of the stuff in here is, you know, the ethics chapter, the getting started types of information, how you do research. So, you know, those OMB 300s have broader implications than just IT. But let's talk a little bit about why a company would want to consider selling to the government. Steve, your company has been doing this now for quite some time.
Right. Well, Amex has been around since early 97. And what we do is help commercial companies, most of them headquartered in the Silicon Valley or up in Boston or down in Austin, the technology centers of the country, mapping their commercial practices to the government procurement process, mapping their marketing messages, their value propositions to the government's market research and requirements definition processes. So it's all about making those linkages from the sellers to the buyers consistent with how the government wants to be buying. So that's what we focus on. And information technology is the area in which we find ourselves. Most of the companies that we represent are doing between 10 and 20% in the government market, 10 and 30% in the public sector writ large. And that's what we're focused on, helping them grow that small part of their overall business in the public sector.
Okay, so you don't focus simply on federal, you go state, local, ed, and health.
Yeah, I mean, we're located here in Washington, so we work kind of federal out.
Right, cool. And Dave, you've been writing about this for almost 10 years now. So what's your feel for companies coming into the market? What's the learning curve, if you will?
Well, it's a steep one, and the federal government is very open to newcomers. However, it wants to do business with people it knows because that's a less risky proposition. So getting in can be difficult. The good news is if you're, say, a services company, once you're here, once you're trusted, once you've shown that you can do good work, chances are you can stay here for quite a long time. You'll also have services companies, in contrast to, say, the commercial sector, can count on pretty steady amount of revenue, again, if they fulfill their obligations, coming out of the government. The government, for a services company, is often a perhaps not widest of margin, but steadiest source of revenue that can be had.
Okay. Steve, you want to...
You know, it's all about staying relevant to the government. And of course, the government is changing now. So some of the engagements that companies have enjoyed where they could count on having people on site for five-year terms, five plus five, you know, are being questioned. And in this world of cloud and agile development and so on, there is a real push to have folks doing shorter and shorter engagements. You know, the promise of some of these new approaches to IT, cloud-based agile development, is that we might have task orders instead of them being for many years, we're actually having them measured in months, to where the government is seeing direct value. And then if you did a good job, you'll get another task. So a real push right now to shorten the tasks, show value immediately as we're in this budget crunch.
Yeah, but you know, we're also in a crunch on 1102s being pressed literally across all agencies. And doesn't that shortening of that cycle up their workload proportionately?
Well, it certainly can. However, if we're using framework contracts, vehicles against which orders can be easily placed, and the program office has really defined their requirements well and their performance metrics, those orders, those subsequent orders can be cut very quickly, very easily. So yes, you make a good point. We have a really compressed acquisition workforce, a lot of young people and a lot of people about to retire, not many in the middle. So structuring these things properly for this new era is critical. But if it's done right, it doesn't add a lot of administration.
Cool. The book is The Inside Guide to the Federal IT Market by Dave Pereira and Steve Charles. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and we'll be back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests are Dave Pereira and Steve Charles, authors, co-authors of The Inside Guide to the Federal IT Market. You can find it at Amazon. It is available as a Kindle. And you can also get it at managementconcepts.com, their publisher. And that would be Management Concepts Press. But you can probably find it through managementconcepts.com. You'll find it anyway. Just look it up. And it's definitely worth going through. This should be in everybody's library. Let's start with the segment with GSA 70 and MOBIS. I know you do more, definitely more on the 70 side, Steve. But are these a requirement for IT companies at this point, or how important are the schedules?
Well, you know,
there?
GSA has statutory authority to run government-wide contracting programs, and the multiple award schedule contract program has been part of GSA since its founding in 1949, running schedule programs for every commodity and every service area, IT 70 for IT and MOBIS for the management consulting type services. The thing that the schedule does for the whole government is it establishes the ceiling prices. Publicly posted prices on the internet that no one in the government pays more than the schedule contract prices. And many of the agency's indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contract programs reference the schedule contract for price reasonableness. So the schedule is the basis for pricing. And as we move into the world of cloud services, intellectual property-based services and products, the terms and conditions on a schedule contract where you can bake those terms in at the part number level, something that no other contract offers. So that's why it's key, terms and conditions and ceiling prices.
Okay. Well, we talk about this in the book about do you need to get a GSA schedule? And the answer is... it's a choice. There are many, many compelling reasons for a company to do so. Steve mentioned many of them. Another one is the fact that simply possessing a GSA schedule gives you a fair amount of credibility in the federal IT market or in any government market. It says that you're serious about pursuing federal business, and it also says that GSA believes you can handle that federal business. But there are circumstances under which a company might not want to pursue that. GSA schedule is an administrative burden. It places a lot of paperwork and recording requirements on a particular company. Some companies have decided that perhaps they're so big in the private sector that they're just going to have a reseller handle all of that for them. This is not really an option for services companies. You really don't have resellers for services. For manufacturers, however, some have decided that. Conversely, some companies are so small that they've decided that the requirements of handling the schedule themselves would be overwhelming. So it's not a clear-cut decision. It's a decision that has to be made with some strategic thinking in mind.
Okay. Steve, you've been doing this for a long time. You used to negotiate management schedules for another company mm-hmm. long time back. How many companies have you seen come into the market and immediately just go for a schedule and, you know, worst case scenario, negotiate it on their own? And then, because I know you guys deal with that in the book too, and I know you're not in favor of that, but you know, I've seen companies come in, you know, all of the schedules, same thing, come in, negotiate it, they're waiting by the phone, terms and conditions are absolutely abysmal, the pricing's bad. What's wrong with this picture, and how often does it happen?
Well, companies need to recognize that the schedule contract locks them into promising a lot of things about their future business practices. And so the schedule contract is a strategic activity in the sense that a company needs to plot its future. Think out 3 years. Plan your practices and policies and how you want to grow your business. Look at everything, finance, legal, operations, before you put pen to paper and submit an offer to GSA. You have one chance to get this right. Changing your story once you're in front of the GSA contracting officer is, it's death, because the trust is gone, and they will say, well, you said it one way, now you're saying it a different way, I can't trust you, I'll just put it off to the side.
It's, you know, but we have a five-year vehicle with 3 5-year renewals, which apparently may be under review. But if somebody negotiates a bad deal, they're either stuck with it or they just have to walk the heck away from the market completely.
Well, they can walk away from the contract. They can terminate their contract with 30 days written notice, but there will always be that record. And when you come back in and try to fix things, GSA will still have the old record. So, I mean, you get one chance to do this right, and it's one of those situations where you really don't want to try to learn on the job.
No, and you know, I see companies balk, and Dave, jump in when you want. I see companies balk when they go, but that guy is going to charge us $10,000 or $15,000 for a schedule, and I'm going, yeah, it's potentially a 20-year contract. What do you think you're going to make off this thing?
Well, something we do advise in the book, and that is, if you're hiring a consultant or a third party to help you get a schedule, one broad winnowing mechanism you might want to use is to eliminate those who say they can get it to you easily and quickly. And it's not because getting a schedule should be slow and agonizing, but it's because it should take entirely as long as it needs to take. You do need to go through all your pricing practices, and you do need to have all those documented. You need to also be prepared to have the government selling side of a business have a fair amount of visibility into the private sector selling side of a business. And in a lot of companies, that doesn't make sense, because it's like the tail wagging the dog. There's a lot of things, a lot of steps that a company has to go through in order to get a good schedule.
Okay. And we go through all of them in the book. We actually give you the long and short of it.
The good, the bad, the ugly. But the fly in the ointment here, coming down the pike yet again, is strategic sourcing. It's been applied to a couple of schedules already. There are certainly rumblings about it being applied to portions of 70. Mm-hmm. So what's the, number one, tell us a little your perspective of federal strategic sourcing, and how is it going to impact 70?
Sure. Well, the Office of Management and Budget has been pushing this concept of strategic sourcing, leveraging the government's buying power so that small agencies get deals comparable to what the large agencies get. And this was always the promise of the GSA schedule itself. However, you just can't afford to give a deep volume discount and have that price posted up on the internet for all the world to see as if it were a quantity one price, right? It will drive your commercial pricing. And we can't have our schedule contract pricing driving our commercial pricing. So what agencies have done is structured blanket purchase agreements to extend the schedule contract, defining more precise terms for an agency or a department, putting in place volume discount breaks. so that the seller can lower cost of sales and the government can reap the benefits of buying in bulk. What OMB and the Office of Federal Procurement Policy would like to see is for that to get extended, not just within departments, as has been done a lot in the last few years, but across departments. And again, to benefit smaller agencies. And the challenge there is the appropriations process. This is the part of strategic sourcing that is not being addressed. Yes, schedule-based BPAs can be structured to accommodate any customer, any size relationship. But the problem is pooling the money to actually buy in bulk, which is what matters to companies because they're measured quarter by quarter, deal by deal.
Right, and there's nothing that guarantees the sales to any particular company on that BPA.
Oh, no, not at all. We still, you know, the system is becoming more and more competitive. The government still wants to have competition, even at the order stage, even under strategic sourcing arrangements. And that is what actually keeps the prices down. To the extent that the government can pool its money and do large transactions and have competition at the order stage, that's where it really saves. That's really strategic sourcing in the government. The government's appropriations process just does not lend itself to program managers giving up money for the greater good.
You know, this conversation we're having right now, it might as well be 2005 outside. There's nothing new under the sun in recent history when it comes to OMB trying to get intergovernmental initiatives off the ground and running into the fact that there's a lot of structural obstacles that aren't going away because they ultimately come down to the division of powers in the Constitution and that can't be overcome. The last time that OMB tried to do a major push was the smart buy for software licenses, and I see that it's trying to do it again. The last go around, it managed through sheer dint of will, and also because one company in particular was caught talking out of school and paid for that. It managed to go and get some software companies to sign up to that and commit to that. But it didn't take hold because the kind of structural impediments that Steve has been talking about just were too great. And not only that, but the payoff for the companies to participate wasn't there either. There was a promise of bulk orders, but there was never
a delivery.
Never a delivery of that. And if you're a software company, you need that promise fulfilled before it's a catch 22. And so this latest example of that, if they're able to overcome that, if they're somehow able to untie that knot, then hands off. But I think there's justifiable grounds for skepticism.
Okay. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guests are Steve Charles and Dave Pereira. Their new book is The Inside Guide to the Federal IT Market. Get it. It is. And don't just put it on your shelf. Read it. Chapter 5 opens with one of the best lines I've seen in a while. How the government buys is not often a function of what is best, but how easily it can be bought. What do you mean by that?
Well, the government has pre-awarded contracts against which orders can be placed, and that's far easier than starting a contract from scratch. Many times we're working with new technology companies, and C-level folks in the government want to hear about that technology, but one of their first questions is it on a vehicle? Because they need to be able to know that it can be bought easily. Spinning up a contract from scratch takes too much administrative cost and time. The agencies just don't have that. They need to have these items on pre-awarded contracts that are easy to place orders against.
And not only that, but agencies have their own favored contracts in many cases. So if you're the Air Force, you're going to be looking to NetSense Whereas if you're DHS, you're going to be looking to Eagle. And so if you're on those contracts, if you want to do business with DHS and you're a manufacturer, it's probably a good idea to have an Eagle contract, because no matter how good your stuff is, if it's difficult for DHS to buy you, then chances are it'll just go with something else that's easier to get.
So the 80-20 rule applies again. So if you're a manufacturer, you're not on Eagle, give me a call. I happen to know a company that has an Eagle contract that might talk to you.
So Eagle is more for services, and the First Source program is more for products, just to be clear.
I got the contract vehicles mixed up.
Yeah. But the point here is there's multiple vehicles out there. And Steve, we were talking before we started the show about the importance of companies that are serious about the market having multiple points of entry that way. Talk about that a little bit.
So in terms of companies entering this marketplace, it's very important to segment the market. That's true of any marketplace. We segment the private sector marketplace into verticals. The government is made up of almost as many verticals. Sometimes we think of them actually as horizontal here in the public sector. And so as a company targets its opportunities, it's the contract vehicle strategy associated with that segment of the market must be addressed. That needs to be part of the mix. Lead gen, sales activities, marketing messages, and the contract vehicle strategy, all part of the mix.
Contracts. When I was interviewing Max Peterson several years ago, when he was between CDW and Dell, he was going from one product company primarily back then to another product company. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, for an IT manufacturer to be successful, you really needed a trifecta of vehicles. And he was referring to vehicles that were open, you know, GWAC types.
Sure. So the vehicles that we're talking about for products are referred to as delivery order contracts, because you deliver something, as opposed to task order contracts, mm-hmm. which are set up to deliver task services under, which is why DHS has First Source as its delivery order contract and mm-hmm. Eagle as its task order contract. Mm-hmm. There are some of these indefinite delivery contracting programs that have special authority in the world of IT, mm-hmm. Klinger-Cohen, statutory authority to operate across the government. And in the world of delivery order contracts, product contracts, yes, this trifecta that you talk about, NASA's SEWP program is by far the largest, most rapidly scaling, growing delivery order contract in the world of IT. The NIH's program, the ECS3 contract, still continues for products. I know that's coming up soon, and there will be a new incarnation of that. And so those are the two primary indefinite delivery contracts that have GWAC authority. Now, within the DoD, we don't have GWACs. They are just simply IDIQ contracts. Mm-hmm. Some do operate across agency lines under Economy Act authority, different statutory authority, such as the ones Dave mentioned earlier, like Air Force NetSense, Army ITES.
Okay. And something that we do in the book, and that is, if you're new to this market, and we just threw out a lot of terms, we actually go in and explain, for example, the fact that if you're on a vehicle, then that moment of getting a slot on the vehicle, that's your contract award. Whereas the actual work or goods that you're going to deliver in that, those come in the form of orders. And as we point out, most mortals in this world would think of the latter as an actual contract. But because of how specialized federal contracting is, you have this very different set of concepts and very different set of terminology that goes along with that. And in the book, we don't assume that you know it. We actually go out of our way to explain it as it comes up.
Yes, we explain it in English, mm-hmm. and we provide all the appropriate legal references so that inside counsel and outside counsel will also see the underpinnings of this. So we have tried to cover the waterfront in terms of the audience's knowledge and understanding of this, taking nothing for granted, plumbing the depths and making sure that it's applicable to the business person, but will stand up to any legal review.
Okay. Yeah. And that's one point that I did not make earlier about the book. It is eminently readable, which, oftentimes is not the case with business books. You know, they tend to be jargon laden. And there, while there is jargon in here, it's explained along the way. So, and for that, I thank you. I also want to thank you guys just for taking massive amounts of time to put this thing together, because it is a great resource. And once again, everybody out there should get it. I want to get into simplified acquisitions for a minute or so. You do a chapter on that. Explain a little bit about what it is.
Sure. Well, the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act of 1994 established this additional method of procurement, simplified acquisition procedures, described in the Federal Acquisition Regulations in FAR Part 13, for commercial products only. These special limited source approaches, it's not a contract vehicle. It's an approach to establish a standalone contract, but requests for quotes only need to be extended to three different companies. So limited competition to establish commercial contracts for commercial products. So simplified acquisition procedures start out as an RFQ as opposed to an RFP. They are set aside for small business if the contemplated contract is expected to be less than $150,000. We refer to that as the simplified acquisition threshold under $150,000. There is special statutory authority for agencies to use these procedures for larger procurements. And there's just a little, you know, inside baseball here. Congress forgot to extend that authority in 2012, but we have good word that it will be back when they pass the National Defense Authorization Act of 2013, which we hope to have by New Year's. I'm optimistic. I mean, the people are saying that we should have it by the new year.
But simplified acquisition, we also go through this. Why is it simplified? Well, it's simplified relative to negotiated procurement.
Yes.
It's simplified because the evaluation that the government has to do on responses to a request for a quotation are not as stringent as a response to a request for proposals. It's simplified because some of the databases, for example, that a contracting officer has to check about your company aren't as stringent necessarily for a simplified acquisition, for a decision to be made about that. It's simplified because the amount, the value of the contract is indeed capped. So basically, it's a compromise that the government is willing to make, and that is no procurements over a certain threshold, but procurements under value less than that, we're going to make it easier for the government to actually buy things quickly. Now, the threshold we were referring to, the $150,000, so that is something that doesn't need periodic reauthorization from Congress. What happens is that under a so-called pilot project that the government has been incrementally renewing pretty much on an, well, Congress has been incrementally renewing pretty much on an annual basis ever since 1997, we think. It's allowed simple acquisition procedures to be used up to a greater amount, which these days, that threshold is $6.5 million. Now, the statutory authorization for that, Congress forgot to extend it.
Okay. forgot, among many other things. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guests today are Dave Pereira and Steve Charles. The book is The Inside Guide to the Federal IT Market, published by Management Concepts. You can pick it up at Amazon or at managementconcepts.com. The Kindle is also available. I would suggest a hard copy simply because I love marking up books and making notes in the margins. And then tabbing them so I can get back to what I want. Steve, the ethics rules, you've got an entire chapter on ethics, but there seems to be a lot more coming down the pike here. So start with what is and then go to what might be.
Sure. So the ethics chapter covers all of the ethics issues that come up in regulations. And it's a complete chapter, and it's readable and it's understandable to a business person. The ethics oversight, the oversight of our business activities is increasing, has been over the last few years. Historically, whenever we've had a time of increasing expenditures and then we have a time of shrinking after armed conflicts, we always have this pendulum shift to where the oversight community takes over. And so we're in that period right now. The ethics concerns that are front and center at the moment have to do with government employees accepting food. You know, it's this $20 limit is almost impossible to stay under. And so one of the real life challenges we are having right now is how to have events, educational events for our government customers that extend for more than about 3 hours, because the minute it's lunchtime, we're over $20. I have noticed that we have box lunches now at most of these events, and apparently the hotels and restaurants and everything downtown are being able to do these things for under $20. But it is a real challenge. It's a real practical challenge right now.
Dave, you want to pick up on that?
Well, sure. The Obama administration came in and they were pretty clear that they were going to increase some of the regulations. They, in fact, there was an executive order that increased the amount of distance that senior political appointees need to have from lobbyists. And the definition of what constitutes a lobbyist can be pretty expansive. And then there was additional talk about another rule about spreading those prohibitions even wider across the federal government. Now, we don't know the status of that rule. In fact, there's a lot of rules out there. There's another big one about organizational conflicts of interest that there was they came out, they solicited for response. This is maybe a year ago in many cases by now. And since then, we really haven't heard what the final rule is going to be. But there's certainly the possibility of more stringent regulations coming down the pike.
Okay.
Right. I think some of these were held because, you know, the election. And so now it will be interesting to see whether the Obama administration will double down on regulation or whether it will ease up. And only time will tell.
Yeah, time will tell. But that brings up my final point here. Time will tell. 17 years now, we have not had a complete budget passed on time. This is some scary stuff. I mean, it's the one thing that's mandated in the Constitution, and Congress doesn't seem to grasp that. Is it a fact of life now, and how do we deal with it?
Right. Well, the fact of life is that these appropriations bills, 12 on each side, House, 12 in the Senate, to fund the entire government, are what folks refer to as must-pass legislation. And so they attract political riders like no other legislation. And as a result, they often sink and don't get passed by October 1. Now, of course, so for 17 years straight, we have not had a complete set of appropriations bills to fund the entire government. This year is different. This year, as a result of the Budget Control Act, the debt ceiling debate, now we're having debt ceiling, long-term entitlements, tax reform, all rolled into the appropriations process. As we stand today, we're operating under a continuing resolution, so all government expenses are coming from the fiscal 12 framework, the appropriation authority of fiscal 12, and we will be operating under that until the end of March. By then, we'll know where we're at relative to the fiscal cliff, And hopefully we'll get a clean appropriation for the remaining 6 months. But this has become part of the regular rhythm in this marketplace, sadly.
And the appropriations bills this year aren't even just wrapped up in the regular amount of political back and forth because of the must-pass status, but because of a fundamental disagreement between the House and the Senate over the size of the government. It's not even just political writers at this point. Right now, it's a philosophical debate.
Right. Serious debate, you know, where it's that debate over Medicare, Medicaid costs and how we're going to trim those programs. And it's over whether we're going to have any incremental revenue. It's the same debate that we heard during the Budget Control Act negotiations, the same debate we heard during the election cycle. We're having it all over again, and hopefully we'll have some kind of resolution by January 1.
So the question is this simply a fact of life? And is it going to be a fact of life well into the near future? Well, who knows? Because prognostication, you know, has a nasty way of turning out to be wrong. But even without the fact of divided government and divided priorities about how big government should be, there has not been a regular year of appropriations bills passed on time within living memory. So even putting aside the current debate, we can probably guess that continuing resolutions in one form or the other can be likely to be a fact of life also within the next few years, within the foreseeable future. And that does have an effect on the way companies are do business with the federal government.
And we'll continue to do so. Guys, thanks so much for coming in again. The book is The Inside Guide to the Federal IT Market by Dave Pereira and Steve Charles. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
This is not my day job. I advise companies on all aspects of marketing to the government, including leveraging social media. I also run the Government Market Master Program at Capital College, which is continuing education for sales, marketing, and business development professionals. If you want information, drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net. And thank you for listening to Amtower Off-Center.
You've been listening to Amtower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear it in its entirety on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Amtower Off-Center, Monday afternoons at noon, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, WFED, your source for federal news now.